Welcome to Running Start, the podcast that's been made to run to. Brought to you by VHI, sponsors of the VHI Women's Mini Marathon. 5 episodes of increasing length, designed to help you gradually work up to 10K on the big day, or any routes after that. In episode 3, for your 45-minute session, you'll hear Jess Murphy.
Hi, I'm Jess Murphy, the owner and chef of Kai Restaurant in Galway City. So obviously you can tell by the accent I'm not Australian. And my food journey started off in New Zealand when I was a kid. My grandmother owned a shearing farm in the middle of nowhere on the east coast of the North Island. And so like every summer we used to have to cook for shearers. And I basically, since hearing like cooking with my grandmother and then also my brother was watching car racing once and he saw the Michelin tires. And I said, what's that? And he goes, well, you know, they basically sponsor like the Navy SEALs of chefs, Jess. And since nine, I just obsessed, wanted to be a Navy SEAL chef. So I suppose my training started being a 15-year-old know-it-all and leaving school. And I was like, I need to be a chef anyway. So basically what these teachers are teaching me is nil and void on what I'm going to do on my journey. And I didn't even know the journey word at the time. I didn't know what I was doing, but I wanted to be a chef. So I started washing dishes in the local restaurant when I was 15. And I carried on in that same restaurant until I was old enough to go to college, which was 18. And I got accepted into a chefing course in New Zealand. It cost me around $21,000 to put myself through college for the year. So after college, when everybody was going to the pub or the swimming pool, I was going to go and cook steaks at Dino's Bar and Grill. So yeah, I really put myself through college and like pretty much self-taught and then just chose restaurants that I really, really loved and chanced my arm of getting in there. Like, I mean, I remember every little step up I got, like I got out of the sink, right? And then I was 16 and my job was to microwave the Mississippi mud cake, garnish it with squirty cream out of a can and fan a strawberry on top of the squirty cream and add a mint leaf to it. And I thought I was amazing. Man, I was the hottest thing in town. You know, just, you know, the way that your head walked up, I was completely, the only way I can describe the other feeling that I got was actually meeting Dave, my husband, absolutely falling in love. So I just absolutely fell in love with the industry. So in 99, I moved to Perth and I couldn't get a job in Perth. So then I went to Kalgoorlie in the outback of Australia and Western Australia. And that's where I met my husband. He was on his backpackers. And then after that, just, yeah, got a job on like a tropical island off the coast of Fremantle, as you do. Really weird. I think they were desperate for staff, which worked out in my favour because the couple ended up being from Mullingar. So they saw Dave was from Carlo and they're like, oh, right, we'll give your boyfriend a job. I was like, this is amazing. So Dave was my kitchen porter for a while on the island. That's when we realised we really can't work together in a kitchen. And so, yeah, that was Australia. And then we moved to Wales and lived in Wales for 4 years. And then I was like, you know what? I just really want to settle down and have kids and go back to New Zealand. Like, that is my whole life now. And then I got back to New Zealand after working in such an amazing, amazing 16th century freehold house in North Wales with, you know, two private gardeners and a private lake, and everyone was drinking pims, to back to cans of beer in New Zealand and can of anchovies being $24. And I was like, I hate it here. There's no way. I need to go and do Michelin. So then I looked up who was the hottest chef that I could possibly find to work with. And at the time, it was Kevin Thornton in Dublin. And because Dave had an Irish visa, sure, it all made sense. And I didn't want to go, you know, back to London, or, you know, everyone was doing London at the time. And I was just like, oh, I should just go and work for Kevin Thornton. So this is how, 2005, I had like $5,000 in traveler's checks. And I rocked up and I got dropped off outside of TGI Fridays on St. Stephen's Green and basically walked past my dream restaurant, which was Thornton's at the time. So that's, long story short, how I got here. Working as a chef in Ireland was really interesting, especially because I couldn't understand anybody. Kevin Thornton's from Cashel in Tipperary, so there was no chance in hell I could understand him. And I remember my interview with him, I was in Dunn Stores buying some pajamas or something, because I was living in a backpackers somewhere in Portobello. I can't remember where it was now. And Kevin rang me for an interview, so I went in there and he was like, well, what's fine dining in, you know, New Zealand? And I was like, well, what's fine dining in Ireland? You know, Miss Attitude, speaking to a two Michelin star Irish chef. Sure, I hadn't a clue what I was doing, like. Anyway, he was like, oh, do you want to start on a, come for a trial? And I was like, absolutely. So I worked there for a year and basically talking about running a marathon, man, that was like running a marathon. I lost so much weight. I remember I worked from like 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock at night. Our deep clean was on a Saturday, so when we deep cleaned the whole kitchen and scrubbed down, we did it as fast as we can because all we wanted to do was go to Whelan's for 3 pints. Worked in Thornton's for a year. You know, obviously I was boning out pig's heads and marinating them in poutine for 3 months and then turning them into a sausage with its own ears. So that was, you know, it was fascinating at the time. And yeah, he's such a legend. And I decided I was going to finish there because, once again, I was just tired and I couldn't even think. And, you know, Dave, God love him, had a normal job, so he always paid the rent and was living in this tiny little studio apartment in Portobello. And I was at home one day watching SpongeBob SquarePants in Irish, which was still my favourite thing to do. And then the Bord Fulcher adverts came on the TV and it was like, move to the west, and then the sea, you know, what an amazing place to live. And I was like, oh my God, where is that, Dave? And he was like, oh, that's in Galway. We used to holiday there, and you know, when I was living in Carlow. And I was like, yeah, I want to move there. Can we just pack everything up and move to Galway? The idealistic bohemian move to Galway was amazing. It really suited my not so normal personality. And yeah, I started working as a head chef in Ardbeer, and I ran Ardbeer for years with Yvonne McNamara, who's in herself a little power pocket rocket, and she was awesome. And so I ran it with Yvonne, and then I kind of, obviously I hadn't taken a break from Thornton's, you know, and I was like, man, I need a break, but I still need to work with food because that's what I do. And I was like, I need something more chill. So then I got a job as a cheesemonger in Sheridan's. Then I became a cheesemonger. So I became a cheesemonger for about 3 years and then specialised in predominantly raw milk Irish cheeses and then learning European charcuterie. So yeah, and I worked for them. That was the best job I ever had in the whole entire world. They're the best company ever to work for. Then I went from Sheridan's to open bar number 8, and then a lady and a gentleman called Elaine and Frank Heenahan came in, and they were florists. And they ran the local florist shop in Galway's West End. And they said, listen, Jess, man, she's from San Francisco. She was like, she always loved me because, you know, she was a hippie and I'm kind of like a kind of hippie. And she was like, listen, I'm going to retire. Do you want the florist shop for a restaurant? Because we got a restaurant license for it ages ago and, yeah, we haven't really done anything with it. And I was like, oh my God. Yes, I want a restaurant. But I've always wanted a restaurant since I was about 16. You know, the dream is being a chef and getting your own restaurant. Starting Kai, opening a restaurant in 2010, no worries, no one's got no money and no one's going to give you a bank loan and you have no savings. What do? Oh, you just pray to God and you walk over the bridge and you go into the Bank of Ireland in Maingat Street. And luckily enough for me, a guy was working there and he was like, you have to write a business plan. I was like, yeah, cool, what's that? You know, what does that entail? Like, and he was like, you know, you have to kind of guesstimate how many people you do for lunch and stuff like that. And a lot of people don't know this about me, but like I wrote for the Times and obviously Food and Wine, but I have dyslexia, so I find it really hard. So I have to get people to help me to write these things. So like, luckily for me, he had all the patience in the world and basically let me sit in his office for maybe 20 minutes longer than everybody else did to help me to just make sure that what I was saying was connecting to the piece of paper, therefore I had a better chance at getting a loan.
You've been going for 10 minutes, doing good.
the challenges involved of going from a chef to a head chef owner, I mean, my God, I've never known my hair to fall out, but my hair started falling out. I was working like 16 hours a day. I was crying into scones. It was hot. I was chafing. There was no air conditioning. I mean, everything was really bad, and not really bad, but really good and exciting at the same time, but really hard. Things I'd tell myself is to learn how to write lists. It's really important to write lists. I mean, whatever's on that list, and it's like, this is really important when it comes to exercise as well. You know, what you do is you wake up in the morning, on your list it's like, have a cup of coffee, chop your strawberries for your cereal or whatever you're going to eat, for your Greek yogurt, whatever. Take a break at like 12:30. You know, all really mundane stuff. Pick up cheese. I'm just trying to think what I do on a day-to-day basis. You know, buy fish, blah, blah, blah. But if everything's written down on a list, you give yourself a sense of accomplishment and you're not overwhelmed. And I think lists have helped me when I'm feeling overwhelmed and I can't sleep. Just get up. Don't worry about trying to go back to sleep or trying to breathe like a, you know, Navy SEAL SAS dude, like all the podcasts say you do. Just get up, write that list, and guarantee you, within half an hour, your mind will set a little game plan for that list and you'll tick them off, tick all those boxes off. So yeah, lists on everything. I know this is going to sound really cheesy, but one of my most enjoyable parts of the day is especially in summer and spring when all the radishes come into season. And because I have an open pass, I can see everybody's face when the plates are delivered down to them. And seeing people smile when the plates drop down to them, because you do something that's a bit of crack, you know, you use a radish as like a really like dodgy like cherry sundae cherry on top of their salad or something like that. And you know, like, I like to have fun with food. Like, all my desserts are called happy endings because everything should end in a happy ending. You know, like, having fun with food and not being a food snob, I think that's the best. You know, if you want your lamb chops well done and kai, hey, that's no skin off my nose. You work hard for a living too. You can have whatever you want. What inspires me is like Irish people and Irish farmers and Irish cheese makers and the people I have growing around, you know, growing stuff around me along the West Coast. But don't forget, I've been working in Galway for about 17 years now. So I have my own grow lists. So I send all my grow lists out in January. And then I have like really weird stuff like Offaly sweet corn and Offaly New Zealand spinach. And, you know, I have all my real groovy stuff there. But I mean, apart from inspiration, like, I don't think food is fashion. I don't like to keep up with fashion. I think there's a pressure to that. And I mean, you can see it with high end restaurants and stuff. You know, one minute they're doing swipes and then next minute they're doing dots. Man, I'm too old for that stuff and I'm too cranky. So what I like to do is just cook really nice, tasty food, and inspiration from that can come from, you know, when you walk into a house and your nana has made a stew and or baked brown bread. It's a sensory, it's like that fifth sense of hearing and smelling and, you know, making sure, like, I'm probably the only kitchen in Ireland that still has wooden spoons because I love the touch. I love the touch of slowly cooking onions and stirring with the wooden spoon. You know, you just have that, and that's where inspiration comes from. And obviously, you know, I work quite a lot with the refugee community, with the UNHCR, so then I have like a huge Middle Eastern twist to it. I was head chef and we were flying along. Kai was getting great reviews and I was like, oh, I have to really do something about my mental health. Like, whether or not, like, it's learning how to cope or whatever I need to do, I need to start believing in myself, because I didn't before. Like all women, imposter syndrome, oh my God, they're not talking about me, are they? Oh, and then you feel immense pressure of not being able to handle something. So I was like, this has to stop, man, because I can't carry on this way. Like, I was 32 when I opened Kai, I'm 42 now. So what I did was I found the best hurler in Galway I could possibly find that trained as a sports psychologist. So I got Tony Regan, the famous Galway hurler, and basically had a few sessions with him, and he made me some really amazing tapes on you're not fake, you did all the work to be there, stand there and actually face the crowd. And so, yeah, a mixture between Tony Og and doing loads of CBT therapy. I just think it's amazing. I think it's good for the soul. work-life balance is, you know, pretty hard to get. But I think when I opened Kai, I was like, right, there's things that's going to change here because, you know, I'm a chef. I'm going to open my own restaurant. And basically, I want to treat people with respect and fairly, right? So what I did was I started paying everybody by the hour. So we went from a really crappy wage. Like normally you'd get a, I don't know, say, for example, 400 euros a week and you'd work whatever, 60, 70 hour days. So I was like, right, I'm going to cut that right out and then I'm going to work whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to pay by the hour. And that was all fine and dandy, but then I realized that all of us were working 12 hour days. And I was like, yeah, this is like, you know, 5 days of like 12 hour days. Plus, like, I'm like 42, so I'm the oldest in the kitchen, you know, and we have 24 year olds. And I noticed everybody was just getting tired. And I was like, listen, lads, what we can do, which is amazing, is that if I'll drop down to 4 days, if you guys want to drop down to 4 days, that's cool too. I mean, 4 days for us is still like 46 hours. And I was like, we'll drop everybody down to 4 days. And what we'll do is employ more chefs. We'll have a more creative kitchen. We won't have tired, cranky people. We'll put people in charge of little jobs. So everybody has their own little job. So the stuff keeps on rolling in. And that's what we do. And then, like, if my lads want to go away on holiday for a month to Thailand in February, they go. They can leave. They can, and then they can have their job back. Same with, like, I have my old sous chef has just had a baby. And I'm just like, take your time, do whatever you want. Come back to me though when you're ready. You know, don't lose that confidence that you had because you're an awesome chef and, you know, don't change and we'll give you the hours that suit you. You know, because you have to look at all these people, they're so beneficial to your business. So you have to treat them right as well. Obviously, like with COVID, the first pandemic, we all baked and ate sourdough and banana bread and like bought all the alcohol that we could possibly shove down our necks because, you know, we were off and that was it. Woohoo. Like we had nights off and, oh my God, we had a life, but also kind of scary at the same time because you couldn't leave your house or leave your 5K. Anyway, so we went back to work in December and that was all hunky-dory and I was like, oh man, I should have really used my time more there. And like, I'm sure everybody like kind of felt the same, you know, going back to work. But then when we shut down again in December, I was like, I'm going to use my 12 hours a day to kind of reevaluate what I'm actually doing for myself and physically. Yeah, so when the second lockdown came in December, I was like, right, man, I need to do something than bake banana bread. And I hate banana bread, so I don't know why I was doing it to myself. Anyway, I was like, right, 12 hours a day is what I physically work. So I'm actually going to put my little pedometer on, which is my little step counter, and I'm going to start walking. And at that point, I was like 20 stone, not that weight and measurements even matter because they don't. If you want to walk and you've got legs or you've got arms and no legs and you can do whatever the hell you want, you just need a body or whatever, not even a whole body. So I was just like, I'm going to start walking. And I walked the prom and kicked the wall in Salt Hill. And I was so unfit coming back that all my hands became like really swollen. And I was like, oh, this is like really scary and I need to consult, you know, somebody about this. My heart was pumping, taking all the blood and pumping it around my body and like obviously draining in my fingers. And apparently that's quite common. I also did text my doctor in the end because I was just worried about my heart and stuff. But she was like, no, you must be just pushing yourself, Jess. Good on you, you know. Like, and I wasn't. And at the time my husband was like, oh, do you want to measure your distances? And I was like, no, I'm not into that. Like, I'm not into measure any kind of measurement, but I know it's important. But yeah, so I just measured the time I was walking and my steps because I wasn't going to measure my weight measurement and all that kind of stuff because your body fluctuates so much, you know. Like if my body fluctuated 2 pounds, then I'd go, oh my God, like this isn't working out for me. I'm just going to bake some more banana bread and have a glass of wine. You know, I'm like really defeatist like that. Well, my personality is as well. So I started doing that and yeah, and I mean, it wasn't easy. Like I've taken 7 months to get 3 stone off, but I eventually did it and it wasn't just like a, oh wow, like It was just a lot of CBT therapy while I was walking, a lot of podcasts, like really positive mental health podcasts, and like, you know, really positive like body image podcasts. Like I started like listening to a lot of Louise McSherry as well, because, you know, like I believe everybody's a different size and stuff like that, and I believe that everybody has their own personal strengths. And, you know, like I was always embarrassed to swim in Galway, but it'd be so hot, and now I'm just like, man, I have three pairs of togs now, and I go down there and I just rock it out in front of all my regular customers that come in for scones and cappuccinos. I don't care. And, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I've got two mates as well, like, that are, like, too scared to swim in down there as well. And I was like, come on, man. We've got to get you in this summer, because we can't have you living life like this. You know, you can't use your weight as a barrier. Yeah, it was just every little bit at a time. My blood pressure went down. My doctor was so happy with the results. I have energy to burn. And it actually makes me feel like going out, because I never really wanted to go out before. Yeah, a positive, healthy, automatic routine. Just get yourself into it and just do, like, all you need to do is do it 10 days in a row and it's a habit. The VHI Virtual Women's Mini Marathon is something I definitely look at doing. Like, I've just started doing my first 10K walks. So I've done amazing 10K walks around Ireland since we could, like, travel into county. So I've done amazing walks in Clare, amazing walks in Connemara. Yeah, I mean, the benefits to walking, I mean, obviously your mental health, and I know it's cheesy because you're like, oh God, I hear this from everyone. You know, a little walk, 20 minutes a day, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, like, they say it because it's true. I was the one that was doing the fun run in the parks where everybody was packing up the road cones and walking behind me, and I was the last one walking. So yeah, that's it. Just have the guts to do it. My top tips, obviously, for the VHI Virtual Women's Mini Marathon is make yourself as comfortable as possible. Get yourself online, get yourself some bust dust. Yes, I said bust dust. It goes underneath your bust and it's a dust like talc and it makes you more comfortable. Get online, get yourself some, there's chafing cream, all sorts of stuff. Ultra marathon runners use it all the time, but, like, I mean, it's absolutely amazing, because the biggest fear I have is chub rub and I just hate it. Also, amazing, like, walking shoes. Go in, no matter how big you are, go into a shop and get them to measure you up for decent walking and running shoes, because the last thing you want to do out of this is wreck your knees. So get something like with a good heel, something nice and light that you feel comfortable in, and yeah, make yourself a decent playlist and ask your mates about decent podcasts, and just always focus on doing something positive when you're walking. And I mean, whatever it is, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, you do you, and just do what you can. And yeah, and I mean, just because it's a marathon doesn't mean you have to run. You can walk too.
You've been running for 25 minutes now. Keep it up.
We have a 50-50, like, working gender balance. I mean, whether or not it's front of house or back of house, you know, in general, the restaurant, obviously we pick the people because they're talented at their job, but also we pick people because we want a fair and balanced workplace as well. Like, all women are crazy, you know, like, to have in the workplace, and all men, you know, that's crazy as well. So obviously things work better when there's a gender balance, for sure. It's a decision that I made from getting changed in front of men since I was 15, because I was the only woman in the kitchen, and I was like, this sucks, you know, I've got to get some more interaction here you know, like I remember meeting Louise Bannon for the first time in Thorntons, and she was the other female chef at the time, and I was just like, oh my God, hi, what's your name? Like, it was so exciting, you know, because you'd just been this little female island floating around like all these hot kitchens, you know. My work with Parabera Forum, I was put forward by Trish Deasy, who's the amazing French-Irish writer, to go over to be the Irish delegate. No one knew I was from New Zealand because obviously my name is Jess Murphy until I got there and I started speaking. Everyone was like, what the heck? And then I was like, it's okay, I live in Ireland. But yeah, Parabera Forum started basically from, I think it was the Time or the National not National Geographic, I think it's Time article of the gods of food. So it was Alex Salter, Massimo Bottura and Rene Redzepi on the front cover saying gods of food. These are the gods of food. And I remember seeing that article that day and I just walked out of Kai and I just started crying because I'd worked all my life and pushed myself all my life, all my career. And then suddenly three men who were representing our industry was on the front cover and they were called gods, right? So I went through the whole article anyway with a fine tooth comb. And I think Alice Waters, who like has done so much for even American cooking, she was ranked at 49 and the rest were men. And so this got everybody worldwide really angry really quickly. So Parabera started doing studies on gender balance in not only kitchens, front of house, bartending, sommelier work, all that kind of stuff. So what we did as heads of our industry is we decided to go for it, and with all the social media power that we had at the time and all the connections that we had in the media, we all took turns of putting all these women forward. And especially that was my job, to put all these women forward in Ireland. And now we have really a really good like a tendency and, you know, for Ireland as a small country. I mean, there's a million inspiring Irish women in the food industry that I want to mention. Obviously, my raw milk guru, Mother Earth, Silke Krop from Corlegi Cheese. To Gráinne O'Keefe, who's opening her new restaurant called May after her grandmother. That's really exciting. To Darina Allen, to Myrtle Allen, to Danny Barry, who's gone through a load of personal stuff and come out the other end as just an amazing woman. Yeah, there's so many strong women in the industry. Yvonne McNamara, Caitlin Ruth. Yeah, and this also stems to my problem of why can't people find other female chef rom representation out there, because there is so many. I remember the first Parabera was in Bilbao in San Sebastian, just outside of San Sebastian actually. And I was sitting there and I was talking to a lady and she was like, I was like, oh, what do you do? Are you a chef as well? And she goes, no, my husband's a chef. I run a restaurant though. I was like, cool. And I was like, what's your name? And her name was Lara Gilmore at the time. And then she gave me her business card and I happened to be talking and sitting next to Massimo Bottura's wife for 3 days. And she was like, oh, you have to come over in Milan and work for me. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. I'll come to Milan. Like, I'm there for a cheese festival anyway. So I'll pop over. I'll do the Referendo Kitchen, which is basically you cater out of food waste from the World Food Expo and you move on. So you do 100 for lunch and you chat to school kids and stuff about the importance of food waste. And then at night, you basically feed the homeless community around the restaurant. But they get served like they would get served as in a restaurant. So there's table service, there's still all sparkling water, there's experts from Rome making sourdough, there's a 20 grand gelato ice cream machine in there. So we made ice cream and everything like that. It was great crack. But what we did was we had to jump on the back of a van when the van pulled up and basically drag all the food waste off the van and actually make a dinner out of it. The work that I did with the UNHCR kind of came up in a conversation. I just got back from Milan working for Massimo Bottura and I saw all that, or how the homeless were served, the homeless people were served. And I was like, to me, it's always been about dignity, providing somebody with dignity. And like, I think that's the lowest you can possibly do is take away somebody's dignity, right? And then like, I was just like, oh, it'd be really cool to do something like start recording like food heritage in Ireland. You know how Australia's and New Zealand's food, well, especially Australia's food heritage, food is absolutely stunning, because in the 70s, they opened up their borders to a load of refugees, the Greeks, the Italians, the Sicilians, all sorts, right? So their food culture is so diverse. And I said, isn't it fascinating how we've only got refugees in Ireland just recently? And what I should do is start recording that, because it's such a new phenomenon in Ireland. I mean, we love Indian food, we love, you know, like we like all kind of food from diverse, Vietnamese, all sorts, right? And so I just started working with doing pop-ups, you know, with refugees that were living in direct provision that couldn't cook for themselves. I started doing pop-ups, and then I started noticing the men who wouldn't sit with the woman are now sitting with the woman, because I'm sitting there and my husband's sitting there and my husband's got the baby, and we've made dal and we've made fufu, which is an African like plump kind of a cassava like ball thing that you dip into a really tasty stew. And I just noticed that like religion and kind of troubles and stuff got all washed away with food, because what I realized was food was a universal language. Anyway, so Jodie Clark got in touch with me from the UNHCR and said, listen, would you like to go on a mission? I was like, mission what? You know, mission impossible. Like, you know, I was like, who calls it a mission? He goes, no, it's actually called a mission. He goes, I'd really love to take you to Beirut, and I'd love to take you to refugee camps in Jordan. And I was like, oh yeah, that sounds class. Like, yeah, absolutely, I'll go. Beirut, wow. And, you know, I never thought anything of it, because you know how people say something and whatever. And so I remember, like, I just won the Blasner Aaron Award. And then that day I had to go to the UNHCR offices and sign a waiver form of if I died over there, no one would be at fault. So I won that and went and signed that form on the same day, and I was laughing my head off and I was like, Jess, you are crazy. No one's ever going to believe this is happening. The week before I was about to fly out to Beirut, I got a phone call saying that New Zealand's in lockdown. It wasn't COVID lockdown. The mosque in Christchurch just got attacked, and no one knew what was going on or who attacked it or whatever, right? And I was like, oh no, because I wasn't going to tell my parents I was going to Beirut or anything, because I'd just freak out. And I was like, right, I'll just tell my dad, so at least anything happens to me, dad knows where I am. I wrote my best mate's number on my back of my passport to ring just in case anything happened, blah, 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 because at that time we didn't know where the attacks were coming from. Yeah, and then a week later I ended up in Beirut, in the middle of Beirut, working with a family who just got their permission to say that they were coming to Ireland. They had no idea where they were going, but I brought over, you know, the Fatty Burke books, the Islandopedias, cyclopedias of counties. So, I mean, I bought at least 10 of those books over to give to kids. And so I remember we were sitting there in like kind of the slums of Beirut, and Dave was there, and Dave was Googling hurling to the kids and stuff coming up. And, you know, we had the chats, and I was like, they're like, yeah, I hear, you know, we had a translator as well. They're like, yeah, we hear Ireland's really famous for donkey milk. And we all just started laughing. And I was like, who's milking donkeys in Ireland? And we were like, nah, factually, we have to stop there. Okay, Sammy, this is the dad, right? And the dad was just talking. I was like, Sammy, that is unfactual. I said, maybe goat's milk. They do milk goats and sheep. But like, yeah, no donkey was getting milked at that time of my knowledge. So I'm really good friends with them now. They've moved to Ireland. And I said to them, when you move to Ireland, as soon as you get a house, you let me know and I'll come and visit you. And so we did, and we did the whole journey. And it was just like, they opened their doors to their house and we both just ran at each other because we couldn't believe that they were there finally in Birr and Offaly. And they had a beautiful house, and like Sammy and his wife were learning to drive and the kids were going to school, and Muhammad, the oldest, was really happy. And yeah, it was just like such a relief and such a burden, you know, a weight off the shoulders for them to actually get to Ireland. So yeah, it was a real life-changing moment. And then obviously went from Beirut to Jordan. And then So we flew into Amman, that was fine. And then we went to Zaatari, and then I went to Azraq, and then Azraq had 35,000 Syrian refugees living there at the time. And I got to cook with the family and stuff like that. But what I find, like, with food, I'm the only food high-profile UNHCR person. So the likes of, like, high-profile are people like Ben Stiller, all that. So the Zoom meetings are kind of like, oh, my God, there's Kate Blanchett. And who else is on there? But anyway, I was on the camp, Azraq, and, yeah, that's when I realised that instead of telling me what happened to them, because they're horrendous stories, like, people just disappear. They're left, women are left on their own with, like, loads of kids, and they have to walk over huge mountain ranges to get to safety, right? It's horrendous what's happening to them. But instead of talking about that, we talk about the smell of tomatoes. And we all from, like, if you're from Homs or if you're from Aleppo, you like really spicy food. And we can talk about, you know, the smell of garlic or, you know, how many olive trees they had. And it's just like, you see their eyes start shining up again because, you know, you're actually giving their dignity back because you're not talking about really horrible stuff that happened to them. You're talking about stuff that they're really comfortable to talk about. And then you also have that respect thing as a chef that you know what they're talking about. You know, like the smell of tomato leaves. And it's just, you know, things that just click that with both of you. Oh yeah, it's 100%. The landscape is completely changing with the refugee community. I mean, they're doing amazing things. Like, I remember going to a house just outside of Offaly, and they were making, it was actually in Birr. Yeah, and they were making like salted cheese out of milk from Lidl. And I was like, whoa, this is pretty cool. I was filming on a tomato farm just outside of Galway with a couple from Iraq. They were really interesting too, and like, I mean, obviously their tastes are changing, but then also like different shops are getting in different ingredients for them, and which is really funny because I have now got this ultimate knowledge of what the hell is where. Like, I know plantain delivery is on a Wednesday in Galway. Like, all the plantains come in every Wednesday, and it's so funny because I'm just like, what are you looking for? And I remember being in the African shop and I asked two lovely Nigerian ladies, I was like, oh, I need to make shitto, which is like this really fishy, hot chili sauce. But one of my friends told me that you could find it in a jar. So I was like, I'm looking for a jar of it. And they looked at me like I was crazy and they were like, why don't you just make it yourself? And I was like, oh, well, you know, show me how to make it. And like, we walked around the shop together for about 20 minutes and got all the bits and bobs. And I actually ended up making it, which was 10 times nicer than it was in the jar. So yeah, like, things are changing all the time. Like, I mean, I cook for a lot of doctors in the university hospitals and they like halal goat and stuff like that. So I do their Christmas parties and, you know, I can always, and like all, like the halal goat is all Irish and stuff like that. So yeah, so it's really interesting. And like, you just see it in mixes. And like, I mean, refugees have been renowned to own restaurants, I suppose. Immigration, like, restaurants are our go-to. And I'm speaking obviously as an immigrant myself, you know.
You've hit the 40-minute mark. Doing well.
I'm currently filming little, like, cooking segments with, say, an Afghanistani couple from Athenry, Bengalis from Limerick, but we filmed in Clare because he's a chef in Dromoland Castle. Yeah, so we're documenting all this, and it's kind of exciting because I'm hoping YouTube or TikTok will pick it up and, you know, we'll really fly with it, because it'd be really interesting to do a series. And the fascinating facts is that, like, all their recipes were using Irish ingredients for, you know, which is, like, obviously part and parcel of what I love doing in the restaurant too. So we have a lot in common. Yeah, so Blaster Books picked up on my idea that I had with UNHCR. So we're actually writing a book. I'm writing a book with Owen Klusky called The United Nations of Cookies. And it's based for real beginner kind of bakers. So what we're doing probably 35 recipes of cookies from all over the world. And it's a book just to take to school so we can talk about different nationalities to school kids and stuff like that, and in the end they get to try the United Nations of cookies. It's a great book. It's going to be, everything from the book is going to be donated back to food education, so no one's taking any profit from the book. Obviously we have to take the payment, no one's taking any profit from the book, so all the money goes back to UNHCR and work projects with food with refugees. So it's a real good feel-good book, and it's a book I wanted to write about anti-racism in schools and to be able to talk about it in a nice way, and then everybody to enjoy a cookie at the end of the boring lady's talk. Probably my proudest achievement so far is my UNHCR work. That's what I want to do when I grow up. Also, obviously, opening Kai is one of the proudest achievements. Like, I always wanted a neighbourhood restaurant. I want to be that cranky old lady when the kids grow up and they go on their first date, that I'm looking out there and going, oh, there she is, look at her now, like she's on her first date. You know, I always wanted that kind of restaurant. So, yeah, I'm proud of Kai, I'm proud of that work, but, yeah. Projects I've got coming up is obviously reopen Kai again, that little chestnut, the restaurant. Open up Kai again, still kind of try and maintain that quality of like work-life balance that I've been focusing on for so long. Still do my 10,000 steps before 12 o'clock if I can, and then work a busy day, but we'll see how we go. So I've got that, and I've got, you know, obviously I'm finishing the United Nations of Cookies, and I've got the Kai cookbook coming up. Yeah, so those are the two things I've got. I've got a few things in the pipeline, but like obviously not definite, but those are a few things that I've got coming up. And I've also got a television series. I'm on Beyond the Menu with Mark Moriarty, which is getting, I think, released in September. And that focuses on obviously the Jess, the Kai, the mental person, obviously crab fishing in the middle of nowhere that I am. In the west coast of Ireland, so that's really exciting. My advice is go to college as well, but also if you don't go to college, that's okay too. You can still learn in a good kitchen. So yeah, don't put pressure on yourselves. Like, I mean, if you're really good and you're really talented and you really love food and love doing whatever you're making with food, yeah, the world's your oyster. You just have to push yourself and work hard. And yeah, that's it. I just really want to wish all the women that are running the VHI Virtual Women's Mini Marathon the best of luck today. Go on, girls, get out there and get them.
Brilliant. You've reached the end of your 45 minutes and the end of the episode. Next time out, you're going for a 60-minute session with GAA legend Cora Staunton. Please rate, subscribe and share the podcast with friends, so we can help others work their way towards completing the VHI Women's Mini Marathon or any 10K route after that. You can register for this year's event at vhiwomensminimarathon.ie. Good luck on the rest of your journey.